Well, hey, question. When do you feel most at home? Like, when are you most at rest or at peace or just feeling like you are home? You know, like maybe some of you that might be like you have a fishing line in the water. You're on the shore or on the boat. Maybe you have friends over in the backyard for a barbecue and you're with people you love. Last night we were sitting around. It's Eli's birthday today, and so he's not the kind of kid who likes to get embarrassed, but because of that, we pulled out some of the old baby videos, you know, like when Eli was born and watching the kids when they're young, and it's just so much fun to go back and revisit that stuff. But we're just kind of laughing and remembering, and they're just being goofy. Braden, you showed up in one of the videos. You were a little kid. But there was something. I looked over at Katie while we were watching, and it was, we're all together with the kids, and it was like, this is good. You know, it's just fun to be home and with family. And so there's those moments that we have where we're like, yeah, this is good. This is right. We're together, you know. There's other times that we long for home, don't we? Like, how much of our lives are spent looking forward to something? Do you do that, like, the end of the workday or the end of the school day or summer vacation or a vacation or whatever it is that, like, you just are zeroed in on, like, I can't wait for this to come. Like, we long for this. Like, there's so much of our lives spent wanting to be somewhere else. Can you guys think of times this week where you longed to be somewhere else? Probably. You know, if not, that's not very many hands. You guys are a very happy group. That's good to know. But when you look at life, there's a lot of life that we find ourselves in circumstances that are not ideal, that we would not choose, that we would long to be somewhere else or experiencing something different, either because of choices we made, choices someone else made, or unforeseen circumstances that would come in and disrupt our lives in some way and would mess things up, and we would long for a time of greater peace. What do we do in those moments of life where we long for greater peace, where we long to be home, where we long for a difficult season to end and we long for some sort of a solution? Well, the scriptural story of God's people and what God has done through his people is full of people that lived for God that were in places they didn't want to be, that they were often where they didn't want to be. Many times they were in exile. And in fact, the ancient Egyptians had a slang term for the Hebrews called hapiru or habiru. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it, but that means dusty ones. And the Egyptians called the Hebrews dusty ones because they were always wandering. You know, they spent time in the desert. They were always on the move. They were a harassed people. And they were enslaved by the Egyptians. And it was kind of a slang, derogatory term. Hey, you're the dusty ones, hapiru. And I went through a while back and looked at all the times people are in exile throughout the scriptures. And this is just, these are just some of the first ones I could come up with. And these are just examples where people were taken from their home and moved somewhere else. And there's various reasons this happens. The first one happened in Genesis 3 when Adam and Eve were told not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But if they did, they'd be kicked out of the garden. They did it. They were kicked out. They were in exile. And we have lots of different times where Abraham's called from his home. Joseph is enslaved and sent to Egypt. We have Moses leaving Pharaoh's house and going out into Midian. We have the big exile later on where Israel was carried off to Babylon 700 miles away. And over again, we see God's people that are disrupted. Things come into their life, and either because of their sin or God calling them on mission, over and over again, God sends people into exile. Now, there's two really big exiles. One of them we talked about in Genesis 3, where the people sinned, Adam and Eve sinned, and they were exiled from the garden. And later on, a parallel story happens in the southern kingdom of Israel. After the northern kingdom was destroyed, God told his people that he said, I'm going to lead you into the promised land. This will be your home. Just obey the Torah. Obey the commandments of the Old Testament. And then you will stay here. Don't worship other gods. You can be here forever. Well, just like Adam and Eve couldn't keep the rules of the garden, God's people couldn't keep the rules of the commands, and they were exiled from the promised land. And that is where we're going to find ourselves today. We are going to be reading a piece of mail written by Jeremiah to God's people who are stuck in Babylon. They had been carried off for 30 years, Jeremiah had this prophecy or this prophetic ministry where he was speaking for God, and over again he was calling God's people to repentance. He's like, don't worship other gods. Don't engage in child sacrifices. Don't violate marriage. Don't do these things. And for most of those 30 years, God's people, the Israelites, ignored Jeremiah's warnings. They just ignored him over and over again. And eventually, everything that Jeremiah told them was going to happen about the Babylonians coming to carry them off took place. Jerusalem was sacked, and all the gifted people were enslaved and carried 700 miles away to Babylon. And this was a very painful and very sad time in Israel's history. And so when Jeremiah wrote this letter we're going to read in Jeremiah 29, if you want to turn in your Bibles or turn them on, I also have the words up there. But when he wrote this letter, it was about 2 years after the people were exiled and carried into Babylon. There were two exiles we're told of in the scriptures, and this is right after the second exile, which was 6 years later. So the exiles, the Israelites living in Babylon, had not yet settled down. They were living there. They didn't want to be there. They were angry. They felt abandoned. They were confused. They didn't know why they were there. And they were feeling homesick, as you can imagine. You know, the food tastes different. The weather's different. It's a weird place to be. And some of the religious leaders, we're told, were actually encouraging these feelings. And they were telling the people, hey, don't worry. God's going to take you back to Jerusalem in less than 2 years. Hold tight. No big deal. But Jeremiah tells us that they are false prophets, and the reality is that God was going to keep them there for 70 years in Babylon, where they didn't want to be. So we're going to read this letter, hear these first few verses, give us some of the background, but here's what it says. This is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles and to the priests, the prophets, and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. This was after King Jehoiakim and the queen mother, the court officials, and the leaders of Judah and Jerusalem, the craftsmen and the artisans, had gone into exile from Jerusalem. He entrusted the letter to Elasa, son of Shaphan, and to Gemariah, son of Hilkiah, whom Zedekiah, king of Judah, sent to King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, it said. Okay, so all the best and the brightest, the best stuff has been taken away, taken to Babylon. People are enslaved. Basically, they're living in servitude there. They don't want to be there. And then we get this letter. And you can imagine what it would be like to get a piece of mail. You're with me, right? Despite myself. You know what that's like, to be somewhere you don't want to be, and you receive that message or that letter. Katie and I dated long distance for so long when we were dating back in the day, and we would write each other letters. And when those letters came in, it was like, oh, yes, this is who my heart longs for. And I'd smell the letter, you know, and read it over and over again, and you're like, you're weird. But Jeremiah writes this letter, and here's what I would have written to them. 4 words. I told you so, right? I told you so, you dorks. You dorks, I told you so. But here's what he says. Verse 4. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. So we'll stop there for a moment. First thing Jeremiah says to the people, not what they want to hear. He says, unpack your bags. He says, settle in. This is where you're going to be. In fact, his news is that most of you, in fact, that are reading this letter will die in Babylon. You're going to be buried there. You're going to live the rest of your days there. You're not coming home anytime soon. And just in chapter 28, there's a false prophet named Hananiah who is spreading the word in Babylon, hey, God's going to judge the Babylonians, he's going to kill them or whatever, and we're going to get to go home in less than 2 years. And Jeremiah's like, no, you're where you're at. Don't just live longing for someone else. Don't try and escape. Be where you're at. Bloom where you're planted. Be there. And I think the Israelites living there probably longed to escape from Babylon. And how much of our lives do we spend like longing to escape from something, where we want some sort of distraction or something to take us off of the whatever our situation is, whatever, you know, form of entertainment that is, or what we put in front of ourselves to try and escape. A couple of months ago, there was a movie that came out, like a dystopian movie based on a novel called Ready Player One, which was about this world that had gotten so bad in the future that nobody wanted to live in the real world. Instead, they'd put on these goggles and enter into the internet, where they were like in this magical, like, fantasy land where they could disconnect for a while. It was so bad. But so many of us live that same kind of way, where we don't want to engage where we're at. We want to unplug. And I think Jeremiah and God would say to the same thing he said to them, is that we need to bloom where we're planted. We're placed somewhere. We need to be willing to unpack our bags. And this world that we're living in a sense, we are exiles right now. We are built for something else. We'll be there someday. But for now, God has placed us here, and we need to live here. And even thinking about how we treat and think about the earth. Like, it says early in Genesis, when God created things and made human beings, he gave them dominion over all of creation. And there's a couple ways you can think about dominion. One of them is that, well, if I have dominion over it, then it exists to serve me. I should do everything I can to use it and to gain by dominating whatever I have dominion over. And that's one way to think about it. And some people have done that when we think about the environment and the world we live in. But also, when you think about dominion in Scripture, godly dominion always implies kind of selflessness and care and humility and others focused. And it's not a liberal agenda to say we should care for the environment. It's not. Of all people, Christians, we should be people that are on the forefront of protecting what God has made and stewarding it and protecting what it is, especially if they are being sacrificed for needs of greed or laziness. Now, Jesus is coming back. He's going to restore everything, but it would be foolish and selfish to assume that it's so soon that we don't need to protect the future and protect where God has placed us. Does that make sense? And so I think we need to be people that, you know, care about what God has made and that we live here. We need to bloom where we're planted and care about that. But just like the Israelites, we live in a world that isn't quite home. And God says, hey, bloom where you're planted. Invest there. Seek good things for it. Everything is different for them. It's not what they long for. And it's, in fact, in the New Testament, Christians are described as resident aliens, people that aren't quite home yet. We're passing through. We're pilgrims, and we should invest where we are. The Bible talks about being in the world, but not of the world, right? We want to be invested where we're at, not just to check out, not just to try and escape, but to seek goodness for around us and to bloom where we're planted. And that gets to the next thing that Jeremiah says, verse 7. It says, also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Yes, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Do not let the prophets and diviners among you deceive you. Do not listen to the dreams you encourage them to have. They are prophesying lies to you in my name. I've not sent them, declares the Lord. So the next thing that Jeremiah says and God says to us is to work for peace. Work for peace. And he says, seek the peace and the welfare of the city. Now, this word that he uses there is an important biblical word. It's the word shalom. You've probably heard this before. We translate it as peace, but it's even more than just that, because peace is the absence of conflict. But when we talk about shalom, we're talking about not just an absence of conflict, but like a goodness and a blessing and a completeness and a restoration and a wholeness and prosperity and beauty and goodness. And shalom, when we work for shalom, he says, work for the peace and prosperity of the city, work for the shalom, seek it. It's about kind of restoring and undoing some of the negative effects of the fall. And when sin entered the world, undoing some of those things. And this was a hard message for the Israelites to hear, because they hated, and I mean, they hated the Babylonians. The Babylonians were bad, bad, bad people to them. And if you want to see how much they hated them, you read the book of Lamentations or Psalm 137, which has some of the harshest, most uncomfortable words in all of the scriptures about how they felt about the Babylonians. I mean, in that psalm, The psalmist says at the end, happy is the one who takes, talking about the Babylonians, their infants and smashes them against the rocks. That's a raw, gnarly feeling that they have for these people. And Jeremiah says to them, you need to love them. You need to seek their peace, their wholeness, their joy. You need to invest in them. You see, Jesus also commands us to love our enemies, pray for those who persecute us. And we have the job of working for shalom even now and letting God's kingdom spread throughout the earth as we bear his what he cares about. See, salvation is not escape. Salvation is not just getting away from a bad world. It's actually God not pulling us out of a world that's evil, but working through us to restore a world that is evil, to become something that is restored and has shalom. And that is our call, is to work for that peace. Tim Keller has this great quote. He says this, "The purpose of Christian salvation is not escape from the material world, but the redemption, the renewal, the healing of the material world. Therefore, not only salvation of the soul and forgiveness of sins, but fighting disease and poverty and injustice is on the agenda of the salvation of God." See, God's people, when you think about like the Jewish people, often assumed that because they were God's chosen people, that he had chose them to be rescued from the world. But the reality is, remember in Genesis 12 and Genesis 22, when God's people were started through Abraham, he said, you will be a blessing to all nations. And so it wasn't that God was using his people to save them from the world, like, hey, I chose you, now I'm going to rescue you from everyone else. No, he chose them to be the means by which they'd be rescued. And the Messiah came through them to rescue everybody. He was about the rescue of all of people through God's special people, not the rescue of God's special people from all the wicked people. Do you see the difference there? That this is about God working through people to bless the world, to work for shalom, and Jesus was the ultimate way that happened. And we are part of that now, making the invisible kingdom of God visible by the way we live, by being people of justice and compassion and mercy and love, and seeking shalom even for those that hate us. Seeking shalom even for those that annoy us or have done us wrong. That's the command we have. That God is still working through creation to restore it, and we get to be a part of that. So he says, work for peace, work for shalom. Let's go on, verse 10. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place for which I carried you into exile. So here's the great news that the people received. Jeremiah says, look, God is not done. God has not forgotten you or forgotten his promises. The Babylonians will pay for their wickedness, and God will make everything okay. He will restore the people. He will bring them back. And so he says, I haven't forgotten. I'm coming for you. And Jeremiah 29:11 is one of the most quoted, like, graduates, you probably had this passage written on some of your graduation cards, I imagine. It's all over the place. You can go into like, you know, a store and find this written out where it says, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you. The word there is shalom, again there, that plans to give you hope and a future, to give you shalom. And a lot of times we read that passage and we're so like hyper individualized in the way we think about ourselves that we're like, oh, this is God telling me. He has a wonderful plan for my life and a perfect job lined up, and you know, everything is just going to be just right. God has a wonderful plan. And you know, there's an element of that that's true with God's sovereignty, but that's not what this verse is saying. This is God specifically talking to a group of people that he has carried out of exile because of their wickedness so they could be restored and come back. And he said, but I haven't forgotten you. I'm still compassionate. I have a great plan, and that plan is Jesus. And that's really a beautiful promise there. That's ultimately what it's saying. It's not that you know, it's this super individual thing. He's talking to a specific people, but that's still good news for us. He tells them that he will make everything okay. And we have read the last pages of the Bible. We have access to that. We know that God is going to come and there will be a new heaven and a new earth and every tear will be wiped from our eyes and he is going to make everything new. But for now, we wait for that peace. So we work for peace and we also wait for peace. Is our last point there, that we wait for God to come and do what he says he's going to do with great hope and expectation. I started reading a book a couple weeks ago. It's a biography of the Apostle Paul, and it's like 480 pages by a guy named N.T. Wright. And it's kind of funny to write that many pages on a guy who only wrote, you know, maybe like 30 pages of material. But anyway, he spends a lot of time talking about the first century Jewish person and what they felt and what it meant for them to be people of hope. And talking about hope and the kind of Christian hope we have, he says this. He says, hope in this sense is not a feeling. It is a virtue. You have to practice it like a difficult piece on the violin or a tricky shot in tennis. You practice the virtue of hope through worship and prayer, through invoking the one God, through reading and reimagining the scriptural story, and through consciously holding the unknown future with the unshakable divine promises. That we learn to be people of hope because we know what God is going to do, and we cling to that. We live that out. And for God's people living in Babylon, being in a new location, being far from Jerusalem, far from the temple, that didn't cause their identity as God's people to end. It just changed the way they functioned as God's people. They had a new mission where they were. They were dusty ones on the move. And in the same way, we are dusty ones on the move. We are in exile ourselves in a world longing for that for God to come and being people of hope and praying and waiting, working for peace and knowing that God is going to bring peace. Ultimately, it's all about him. There's something about being out of place and out of your comfort zone that focuses you for mission, doesn't it? Something about like when we did this mission trip to Los Angeles last year, and I've been a part of other mission trips, if you've ever done that, or if you've been a part of a service project, something about stepping outside of yourself and going somewhere with other people for the sake of serving, no matter how uncomfortable it is, that's God does something in your hearts, right? He lightens you up and shows you how to be different. When we don't try and escape from the world, but engage with it. And we, as God's people, are really on a never-ending mission trip, even right now, that we're representing God in our community, in our world. That is our charge. That is our task, to work for shalom and wait for God's shalom to come. To kind of summarize kind of what we're talking about, God's exile. There's a video that the Bible Project just put out just a little bit ago, and I think it's really excellent kind of summarizing what we're talking about, and partly because the first thing I'm doing on this sabbatical is I go to Western Seminary this week, and I'm taking a class with Tim Mackey, who's the guy who narrates these videos. He's a brilliant scholar, but mostly I'm showing it to you because it's really a helpful understanding of exile and what our roles are, and he'll do a better job saying what I'm trying to say. So,
there's something about being home, where everything's just right. We're surrounded by people we love and trust. There's a feeling of stability and safety.
And while some people get to experience this kind of home, many do not. Others might even be forced to leave their home and go live in a foreign land. We call this going into exile.
Yeah, in exile, everything is disorienting. You're in the unknown.
And in the story of the Bible, this is where the ancient Israelites found themselves, conquered by Babylon, living in exile, far from their homeland.
And so they had to ask themselves, how did we end up here, and is there any hope of going home?
And the whole story of the Bible is designed to address those very questions.
The whole story? Really?
Yeah, go back to the first pages of the Bible. Where does humanity live?
Okay, they live in this really sweet garden, their home.
And they're there on one condition, that they trust and follow God's one command, and they don't. And so the consequence is banishment from the garden.
Ah, they're sent into exile.
Exactly. And so this story's been designed to set you up for Israel's story. how they were given the gift of the promised land and were able to stay there on one condition, that they be faithful to the terms of their covenant relationship with God.
They didn't, and they were sent into exile.
And if you still don't see the parallel between exile from the garden and exile from Israel, think about this. In Genesis, humanity's exile led up to the story about the building of what city?
Oh yeah, Babylon. The same place the Israelites are sent.
But that's not the end of either story. In the first Babylon, God called Abraham to leave and travel to the promised land. And that story was designed to give hope to the Israelites currently living in the later Babylon.
Now, eventually, they do get to leave and travel back to their promised homeland.
And when they did, it wasn't home sweet home. Oppressive empires were still ruling over them, and the people kept acting in the same corrupt ways as their ancestors. And so the biblical prophets said that exile wasn't actually over.
How could they think they were still in exile when they're at home?
Yeah, this is really important. In the Hebrew scriptures, Israel's Babylonian exile became an image of something more universal. It's that feeling of alienation and longing for something more, no matter where you live.
Yeah, I can relate to this. I have a great home, but it's situated in a world scarred with pain and broken relationships, death, tragedy, done by others, but also done by me.
And so in the Bible, exile is the human condition. We all keep repeating this pattern of human corruption leading to a Babylon that we can't escape. And it doesn't matter where you live, we are all longing for a better home.
Now, Israel's scriptures held out hope that one day God would send a king who would rescue the world from all of the Babylons we've created.
And after many generations pass, we meet this Israelite named Jesus of Nazareth. He wandered about with no home, announcing the great restoration, that reality of home that Israel and all humanity has been looking for.
Yeah, Jesus really cared about people who didn't have homes. He welcomed in the stranger. He said God's love is shown when you invite in the outcast and throw parties for people who don't have a place to belong.
Jesus also claimed that Israel and all humanity had lost its way, that our self-centeredness drives us to create false homes based on status and power, and these inevitably exclude others. We live in an exile of our own making. But Jesus said the true way home is one of weakness, of service, and of forgiveness. And then Jesus went into exile alongside us to show us the true way home.
Which is?
Well, Jesus said he is the way. His life and self-giving love proved more powerful than humanity's failure. He opened up a pathway to our real home. And as Jesus' followers committed themselves to him, they discovered this new way of being human. They believed that the real return from exile had begun. And so they would call themselves sojourners or wanderers.
Oh, right. They would say things like, the world isn't our home, and we're citizens of heaven.
And so Jesus' followers remain exiles as they wait for that day when Jesus returns to transform this world into a true home.
Pretty cool. I hope that that's helpful for you. That's helpful for me. So, but we are exiles living in a world that God is restoring, has already restored through Jesus, and we are declaring the way back home to the rest of the world. And the next thing we're going to do this morning, normally we do communion on the first Sunday of the month, but because we had Grad Sunday and the picnic last week, we're doing that this morning. But God calls us to be people of hope and of shalom as we live in the world, working for that, waiting for that, functioning as God's people, being like dusty ones on the move. This last year, our SALT team read a book by Eugene Cho, and he talked about the ways that he wants us to, or God calls us to live different lives in such ways that people see how we live and give praise to God in heaven. And talking about how we live as pilgrims and as people of hope, he says this. He says, rather than fear, guilt, or shame, let's inspire people with hope, beauty, and courage. Let's fascinate, not force people towards the gospel. Don't just tell us what you're against. Demonstrate what you're about. Fascinate us, compel us, Help us. No, invite us. Help us imagine a better story. And that better story is demonstrated most powerfully through what we're going to do right now, through Jesus rescuing us. And when we take communion, we eat and drink bread and fruit of the vine to remember and participate in what Jesus did for us. And it is a sign to the rest of the world about God's activity and what God has done. And so we eat together, declaring the work and the ongoing activity of God together.